Morning show at East Coast, and the cool scientist is here, Sean Duke. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Declan. How are you doing?
Good morning to you. How's the world of science?
The world of science is busy and hectic as usual, yeah.
And you're being funded, well, not you, but scientists are, generally.
Scientists, yeah, are being funded for all kinds of stuff. One thing I'm getting more interested in now is the whole science of agriculture and sustainable food, and I'm doing a podcast on that, actually, which is supported by Chagosk, which is our agriculture body. And, you know, that's a huge issue, obviously, because are we going to move away from meat? What are we going to do about our dairy? How can we produce it so that the emissions are kept down and we still produce good quality milk? There's huge issues, and the use of course of nitrates and fertilizers. We're using too much of those, basically, and we're also our land is being depleted because we're with this intensive farming. We're using every scrap of land that we have available, which means you have to use more nitrates then to recover the soil. And of course, that's all a knock-on effect. And then you have issues to do with biodiversity because of this intensive farming. The creatures that would normally live in the hedgerows and around fields that are not being used, there's less and less areas that are just wild. So the biodiversity is under threat. So there's a lot of issues. Really.
Now, of course, just to place on record, the farmers say that they are the most efficient when it comes to the ecosystem in the world for producing their dairy and their meat. And if there's any cutback on all this, that they should be the last to go because other countries don't have the same standards.
Well, that's true. The farmers are very good in Ireland, but we still have an issue there that we have.
Why should we be first? Do you know what I mean? Why don't we stop all the people that are worse?
Well, for example, because we want to save some of our own species, like think of the curlew is just one example, that the poor old curlew is nearly going extinct because it nests on the ground and there's less places available for it to nest where it can be in kind of the grass where it's hidden. So we have to, unless we want to lose our own native species like the curlew, maybe even the salmon, if we care about those things, we need to look after our own house.
Right, so that's the thoughts of it anyway. That's the project you're involved in.
That's one of the main ones I'm doing at the moment, yeah. It's called the research field, actually.
Okay, well, when you can talk further about it, we want to hear about that. The subject for today that the scientists have been looking into is brains of left-handed people develop differently. Now, I've known many left-handed people, and all the ones I've met are particularly intelligent, I have to say.
Are you right-handed?
And unfortunately, I'm right-handed. But I remember in school, and this is quite true, there was a Christian brother who used to give an appalling time to a left-handed guy. Now, that was only one in all the years I was in school, because in other ones, it became a source of, well, you're a left-handed, by other teachers and other Christian brothers. But one particular guy was just so nasty, I always thought, to a particular pupil for writing with his left hand.
That's right. I've heard that, from, say, my dad's generation, more than, you know, my own. But it's strange, isn't it? Because they obviously wanted orthodoxy. They want everybody the same. And somebody that was left-handed, they must have seen that as some kind of a threat because it was different. And they wanted everybody to just be like the machine going through school and produce them in a certain way. And the word actually in Latin for left is sinister, which is interesting. You know?
Really?
Yeah.
What is sinister, it in Irish? Quitog, isn't it? Quitog in Irish?
My Irish isn't as good as my Latin.
Well, I think I'm trying to think back now, because it's a long time since I was in Colostuira, Carnog, Fornell. Lán Gaeilge school, you know. So I think it was Quitog.
Quitog, exactly. So very interesting that along with trying to have a very orthodox view of religion and society and all of those other things, they actually were trying to force people to all write with the right hand. So I think it was a mentality that existed at the time, and they didn't want to foster difference or maybe creativity or whatever. They just, you know, they wanted people to be churned out and all be similar, if you like.
Yeah. I don't know, is Garrett Farrell left-handed? I'm not sure. They're a news guy. Anyway, what's the story? What have scientists discovered?
So the story, anyway, is basically with this, that they found that left-handed people have better verbal skills. Like yourself, I know a lot of left-handed people. We all do. And I was just going through some of the people I know, and a lot of them are actually very creative types, and they do kind of creative things and creative jobs. So it's just kind of interesting. And it seems from this research anyway that their brains develop differently in the womb, and that's thanks to a number of genes which make them better at verbal tasks. So the left-handed person, the brains are slightly different, of course, you know, that from the right-handed and the left-handed person. And there's four genetic regions that have been discovered which may cause left-handedness. And these regions also play a role in allowing the left... There's two verbal areas of the brain that are responsible for our verbal skills, one on the left side, one on the right side. And what these genes that cause you to be left-handed do, apparently also, as a kind of a sidebar, they allow the two areas to communicate better. So you're using your verbal skills from your left side and the right side of the brain better. They're communicating, and you're more dexterous and flexible, and you're able to handle language better. And it fosters creativity, it seems, as well, because, you know, we do have your Leonardos and your Paul McCartneys and your Jimi Hendrix, all of these people.
Yeah, Paul McCartney is left-handed. That's right.
He's left-handed, yeah.
And he said that somebody was teaching him, was it George Harrison was teaching him the guitar? And he says, you're trying to ruin my whole career by trying to get me to play a right-hander.
Yeah, exactly. And you'd wonder, of course, from an evolutionary point of view, why we have it, because 90% of the people are right-handed, and it's been the same, the scientists say, for the last 10,000 years, as far as they can make out in human existence. So why do we have the 10%? Why does that persist? And maybe there's some evolutionary advantage to having a few, a small group that have better verbal skills. You know, maybe that's the leader who's going to negotiate with the other tribe on the hunter-gatherer planes. Who knows? But it's persisted for a reason, and it seems to be linked in with this creativity. And maybe we just need a certain number of people that think in a different way so that society is healthy.
Right, so it could
be homogenous
in evolution like that. Well, very good. So can you actually say definitively that being left-handed is better for verbal skills and intellectually or anything like that?
You can't say definitely. No, these are population studies. So that's
definitely maybe. It's an Oasis job.
So you have a better chance overall, but for each individual, of course, you could have a left-hander that doesn't have good verbal skills. That can happen, obviously.
Okay. Now, the doggies, because they are man, as in the human race's best friend, of course, not women. Diamonds are women's best friend. Dogs, because they live so closely to us, we have influence their evolution.
Yeah, and we kind of know this in a sense, but there's a new aspect to the story, because we've lived with dogs for thousands of years now, it seems, and of course the variety of dogs is just unbelievable. When you think that every single dog is related to the original ancestor, the wolf, it's just incredible, because you have your little Pomeranians who are tiny, and then you've got your giant Great Danes, and you've got every single variety, and of course they were bred to do different things. They were bred to hunt, they were bred to do this and that, and we've known that the breeding makes them look different. I mean, we've got lots of different breeds. But what they did here was to see, did we actually influence the brain structure of the dogs? So we're back to the brain scans now that we've talked about a lot in here, these MRI scans. And in Arizona in the USA, they took purebred dogs from 32 different breeds, and they checked out their brain. And they saw a huge variation within the different species of these purebred dogs. And they say that this could possibly explain the different behaviours. So certain parts of the brain are being developed and certain parts in response to the needs. For example, you have a beagle that can sniff out a cancer tumour. It's so got such a sensitive sense of smell. So obviously that area of the brain that's associated with sense of smell is very highly developed. You've got your border collies, which have this incredible spatial ability where they can gather all the sheep and put them into a pen. Then you've got, I felt sorry for this when I was reading about this, the dogs that are bred for sport fighting. Now that's really, it's illegal, but I mean it's been there throughout human history. And unfortunately these guys, they have very high levels of development in the brain, parts of their brain, the primitive brain that's associated with fear and stress and anxiety, so that they're basically ready to go for a fight at any stage, and they go through life like that. And of course, we know in the human world, that can lead to all kinds of suffering, it's linked with depression and things like that in humans. So those poor dogs have to suffer that. And then you've got your boxers and your Dobermans. They're the police dogs often. Again, their sight, they've got brilliant sight, brilliant smell, and that relates to the brain. So we've actually not only evolved different looking dogs, massively different looking dogs, but we've also changed their brain. So we've influenced the evolution of the dog.
Right.
And the scientists are saying, well, look, we've incredible power to influence the development of species around us, particularly those living close. Maybe the cat is the same, maybe not to such an extent.
Can we influence ourselves?
We can, yeah, absolutely. Because
can we change the human race? Type of influence.
Well, we continue to evolve. So we're now in a modern situation. We're not hunter-gatherers anymore. We're still evolving. There's an argument over what way we're going to evolve. Are we going to end up like the comic story Wall-E, where we're all, you know, unable to walk and we're just sitting in these kind of hovercraft wheelchairs because we don't need to exercise as much anymore? But we're definitely evolving. And there's certain things that persist in our society for thousands of years, like the gay gene, for example. But there are other new abilities that obviously are important in our worlds that we're evolving, and we're not quite sure what they're going to be.
Right.
We could look a lot different in 10,000 years.
Okay, but back to the original story of it. As I mix up my canines with my equines, it's horses for courses that we've bred them differently.
Yes.
And you were saying about this gay gene. Now, that is maybe a curiosity for some people. Other people from maybe a particular religious or conservative point of view might say it was an abnormality of some sort.
Yeah.
But what is the story around this alleged gay gene or whatever?
The science, even the science, this is a massively controversial subject, and I looked at different, usually when you look online and you're looking at a science story, you could look in multiple sources and everybody reports the story more or less in the same way. It's not like politics where you can have different spins on things. But I noticed with this particular story, say in the UK, the way The Guardian, for example, reported this story was different to the way the Tory kind of supported press reported it. And to try and just stick to the science of it, they wanted to see if there is this single gene, gay gene, and they used a massive amount of data. They have this thing called a biobank in the UK, which is 400,000 people have their blood samples in there, so they've access to all of that. And also, that you might have heard of this 23andMe, where you can go and get your genes tested in this kit. You can get it online, it comes back, it tells you about your heritage. So that they tapped into that, and that was another 68,000 people, and they put all of that together, and they asked people about same sexual experience, and they reported 4% of the men said they had same sex experiences and 3% of the women. Seems a bit low, but that's what was reported. And then they looked at the genetics and they tried to tie it all in together with the people reporting that they were gay to try and see, was there something in their genetics that made them different from all the other people? And they found that actually there is no single gene that's going to make you gay. I suppose that's the news part. There is not a single gene that they could find anywhere that is responsible for somebody being gay. But they did find five what they call variants, you know, five kind of different types of genes, if you like, that when you put them all together, they have an influence on whether you're gay or not. Now, you have to be careful there, because one of those, for example, is linked to male pattern baldness. So, you know, I'm losing a bit of hair, but I don't think I'm gay. So you might have one of these variants, you might have two of these variants, you still may not be gay. So it's complicated. And then there's also another factor that's related to this, and that's the hormones in the womb. They think that the way the woman releases hormones in the womb while the baby is there developing could influence whether they're gay or not. So the story, to just summarise a very complex kind of piece of research, they're probably saying that about 50% of this is biological and about 50% of it is environmental. And the example I can think of is, let's say, height. So, you know, back in the 80s when I was in school, you used to see the Americans coming over and there were always huge, tall people, you know, much taller than us, and some of them kind of very big. That's related to diet as well as genetics, you know, because a lot of those would be Irish Americans. So with height, the environment you live in, if you've got good diet, if you've got regular sleep, all of that can make you taller. So you could have a gene for being tall, but you could have an environmental factor that's pushing
which influences.
The same with the gay thing.
Okay, so if buts and maybes, no definitive is the answer. Okay, you've 1 minute to tell us the other story, if you don't mind. Before you blame screen time for teen mental health issues, read this. So we always like to say, oh, they're spending too much time on social media and the screen time, etc. It's affecting their mental health. Science has been looking.
Yeah, huge issue. All parents are interested in it. Do you know what? I think it's been overcooked. I've only a minute to mention it. So to me, just looking at this, it seems to me a bit like the way our parents in the 70s, 80s, 90s used to say, get off that television. It's no good for you. Get square eyes. It's bad for you. Because now it's the smartphone, and the smartphone is a different technology. And this study, anyway, from the USA has found an extensive study, no link whatsoever with depression, anxiety, suicide in teens. They couldn't find any definitive link. And in actual fact, in this study of 2,000 people between the ages of 9 and 15, racially mixed, economically mixed, the whole lot thrown in together, they actually said that if you deprive your child of the smartphone, that might be a negative because you might be isolating them from their peers who are all socialising online. And also, if the child is producing content of their own, this is fascinating, so they're actively uploading stuff that they've produced, that's actually a very positive sign rather than being passive. So it's how you use it. And I notice my little girl does this. She does videos with her friends and they put them up and everything, and it's great fun. So she's not doing it on her own. She's doing it with three or four of her pals, and then they watch the video. So I think we need to, you know, cop on to ourselves here. It's a technology. It's not evil. It's how you use it. Not necessarily even the amount of time you're on it. It's how it's being used while they're on it.
Very good. God, you summed up that pretty quickly.
Yeah.
That's great.
Okay. I'm interested myself in it because I have three kids.
Yeah, so, indeed.
Okay. If they're producing content, which my little
creative,
girl, and they're being creative with it, and they're using various creative apps.
So it's developing their personalities and their skills.
Yeah.
Right, that is the cool scientist Sean Duke there, debunking a lot of science this week. And Sean, all his stories can be found on sciencespinning.com. Sean Duke, thanks very much indeed, Sean. Good to see you as always. Morning Show, East Coast.